Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Remember the Rubik's Cube? This faddish puzzle from the 1980s delighted some but frustrated many others, me included. But you might be surprised that this cube with over 40 quintillion permutations has now become a hot nerd sport. Speed cubing is a worldwide competition with thousands of devotees, contestants vying to solve the puzzle as quickly as possible. How quick? Imagine 10 moves a second, or solving the cube in less than 5 seconds. That's the world record. For many, solving Rubik's Cube in under 20 seconds is the equivalent of running a 4-minute mile. And that was the goal of my guest today, science writer Ian Scheffler. Ian Scheffler's tie to the cube goes back to his childhood, as does his interest in math, science, and engineering. His team won the U.S. Department of Energy's National Science Bowl back in 2008, a Jeopardy-style competition. And he's written for The New Yorker, The Guardian, The Los Angeles Times, and The Los Angeles Review of Books. In his new book, Cracking the Cube, he enters the world of speed cubing, which has been a part of this puzzle's culture since the very beginning. He recounts his own story to get below 20 seconds and also scores an interview with the reclusive founder himself, Hungarian architect Erno Rubik, who's still very much alive and still tinkering with puzzles. The name of the book, again, is Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik Cube Solving. Ian Scheffler is our guest. Ian Scheffler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, your book, Cracking the Cube, documents your ongoing fascination and really almost a addiction to solving the Rubik's Cube. Now, you're of the age where you were not really aware of the Rubik's Cube in its first rendition, and it kind of went out of style and then all of a sudden became back in style again much later. What was your first introduction to the cube?
Yeah, like you say, I was born in the 90s. I really had no idea when I first saw this in a science museum gift shop in the late 90s that it ever had been anything other than a trinket. I mean, I didn't know it was a puzzle at first, which was actually very appropriate because the man who invented it didn't know he'd made a puzzle at first either. But I didn't really fall in love with it until I went to this very unusual summer camp. The New Yorker once wrote about it and called it nerd camp, just straight up. They didn't beat around the bush. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, and Lady Gaga, the musician, went there when they were little nerds. And on the very first day, I happened to sit next to the greatest Rubik's Cube solver on the planet. I didn't know that's what he was, but he taught me to do it. And years later, I found out he and his brother had essentially created the FIFA of Rubik's Cubes. And they're less corrupt because they have less money, but they're in, you know, they're on in practically every country on earth now.
And I think for many people who, I was of the age where, I guess I was in college when the first Rubik's Cube appeared, and I never could solve it. So it was, I remember the craze for people who did solve it. Most people would probably be surprised to know that there's this whole new generation that are so into this. I mean, it's every bit as big or almost as big as computer gaming as far as this sort of competition element to solving the cube.
Yeah, well, there's a big overlap between, say, you know, kids who are into Minecraft or computer games like that and kids who show up at competitions. And I think, you know, part of the attraction is that it's not digital. I can't tell you the number of, you know, parents I've met at competitions bringing their kids who are just overjoyed that their kid is involved in something that's totally outside the digital world. And it's kind of interesting that people who make Rubik's Cubes have tried over the years to digitize it, but it's never succeeded on the level of the cube. There's something about the physical nature of solving it that seems even more attractive in a world that's ever more and more online.
Now, once you you said you were introduced to it, when did you begin interested as far as writing about this culture and also getting involved in the culture as far as the speed solving of the cube?
So I was interested in writing about it more or less right away in the sense that when I found out it existed and that I have this deep personal connection to it, which I'd been previously unaware of, I had all these questions, like, how did this come about, you know? And then that led to questions about when did competition start in the first place and how did people solve it in, you know, under 10 seconds as they do now, or under 20 seconds, which is my goal in the book. How did the cube get out of Eastern Europe? You know, it was invented behind the Iron Curtain in a very inauspicious place for a commercial product to spring forth. And so I had all these questions, and I said to my old friend from summer camp, can I come write about it? Because there was going to be a competition in a dumpy casino in Las Vegas that's since been destroyed. They, you know, drove a truck through the door for the last Jason Bourne film and I think called it quits after that. But I went to this competition and I was originally just only going to write about it. I was just going to observe and take notes and my friend got pretty irritated at me, and he said, how can you write about it if you don't compete? And he had a pretty legitimate point. And there were sort of two things that made me think that there really was something more than I'd imagined. And one, I'm going to demonstrate right now. Can you hear that little clicking noise?
Yes.
So that clicking noise is a Rubik's Cube I'm twisting right now. And try to imagine that noise multiplied by several hundred people in a very enclosed ballroom. And you'll get a picture of just the massive energy that you feel at a competition like this. I mean, I was standing outside the door, and it sounded like there was a hurricane on the other side. I had no idea what was going to greet me. And when I opened the door, I saw this kaleidoscopic, you know, montage of people solving Rubik's Cubes one-handed, blindfolded with their feet. They were doing big cubes, small cubes, you know, pyramids, dodecahedrons, and I didn't know how they were doing any of it. And I wanted to find out. And the other moment that gave me a sense that there was something unusual about this world, and honestly quite funny, was later that evening in the casino. I was just taking notes, and a boy came up to me. He was probably 12 years old, and he nonchalantly asked, may I lube your cube? And I really didn't know how to respond. It seemed so inappropriate. And he just said, you know, it'll really improve your performance. And then I knew even less what to say then, but I kind of meekly nodded and handed him my cube, and he pulled out a syringe and injected it with some silicone oil. And it, you know, I lube my cube myself now, like any good cuber. So it showed me that people take this really seriously. And, you know, the writer Adam Gopnik once said that all writing begins with obsession. And it's sort of about translating your obsession to other people. And, you know, I very quickly got obsessed, partly because I wanted to learn how to do it. But once you start getting faster, it's this very meditative experience that has a lot less to do with math and numbers and logic than the sort of, like, you know, those moments of calm and stress and duress that you find when you're playing sports or doing music or any other sort of, you know, activity like that.
Do you find it is a sort of a release from whatever you're working on during the day? You just pick up a cube, do it a little bit, and all of a sudden you sort of have this refreshing moment?
Oh, totally. I carry one with me practically all the time. It's almost like passing rosary beads to, like, pull it out, just work on it. Funnily enough, so the kid who taught me years ago, he was actually hired to teach Will Smith for that movie, The Pursuit of Happiness, which a lot of people saw. So Will Smith really could do it, but I spoke to the producers of that movie, and even they have Rubik's Cubes still, and I asked if they can solve them, and they used a couple blue words and said, of course not. I said, well, what do you do? And they said, well, we just tore the stickers off, and we play with it under the table in meetings for stress relief, you know, so he's these Hollywood big shots. Even to this day. I mean, he said he had one next to the phone as he was talking to me. He just twists it around because it's kind of relaxing.
Actually, you found very quickly that the old Rubik's Cube for these competitions, that's probably not what they're using. They're using these, what they call speed cubes.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, everyone calls any cubic puzzle that twists and has colors a Rubik's Cube for the same reason most people just call facial tissues Kleenex. It's the brand leader. It's what everybody knows. And most Rubik's Cubes are Rubik's Cubes. But for competition, you know, your goal is to solve as fast as possible. And so in the last 10 years or so, there's been this whole new crop of puzzles that are, you know, almost like the Ferraris of Rubik's Cube is how I think of them. And they've got very different interior mechanisms that are curved. And, you know, the one I have is a GANS 356S, so it almost sounds like a sports car. It's got anti-corner twist technology and corner cutting at 45 degrees. And, you know, the jargon gets kind of off the chain. It's up to the point now where the newest puzzles, and if folks follow the news, they might have heard a new world record was just set the other week in Java at a competition in Indonesia, and it was 4.74 seconds, which is, to me, mind-blowing, and I've solved it in 11 seconds. It's incredible, and that was with a cube that had magnets in it, these tiny, like 60 tiny neodymium magnets, which almost acted like power steering, so that when you twisting it, you know, 10, 15 times a second, it snaps into place more easily.
And one of the things about the Rubik's Cube, when you're talking about these ultra-fast solvers, you're talking about, what, 40 to probably 50 moves to solve a cube somewhere?
Yeah, it takes, like, you know, if you're lucky, you can get a few fewer, but, you know, maybe around 55 moves on average.
And so you're talking in a four-second range. That's like 10 moves a second.
Yeah, and what's really mind-blowing is that, you know, because the cube is so complicated, I mean, it's got 43 quintillion permutations, which is such a big number that early marketing materials misquoted it. They just said it was billions, which is like saying Bill Gates has a lot of pennies. Like, it's a gross underestimate. No solve is ever the same. I mean, I will go my whole life probably at this point playing with this thing, and anyone who ever picks one up, you know, you'll never get the same beginning position twice ever unless you make it that way. And so when they're doing those, you know, 50 moves in, you know, 5 seconds or whatever, what's really incredible is they're making it up as they go along. I mean, it's one cuber in the book I speak to describes it as playing chess at the speed of ping pong. because you're doing what a grandmaster does. You're trying to, you know, envision the next step and the step after that and the step after that. But at the same time, you're doing it in this incredibly compressed space.
What you found out as you began investigating this sort of world of competition involved with a cube is this is goes back to really to the cube's beginning. What do you suppose it is about the cube that makes people want to compete to see who can do it the fastest? Because, you know, I can think of any other puzzle. I know there probably are other puzzles today, but going back to the 80s where there were competitions to see who could solve a puzzle the fastest.
Well, I think part of it has to do with this idea that's become attached to the cube, that it's sort of a sign of genius or intelligence. I mean, you know, that's the role it plays in the pursuit of happiness and in a lot of films where it shows up, or in the TV show Sherlock. You know, Sherlock Holmes has it on his desk. Edward Snowden famously has used the puzzle in his own life to, you know, spill the beans to those journalists, and he used to play with it at the NSA. So, you know, I think part of it might be sort of, you know, maybe in the early days people were like, you know, because it's hard and because we really respect people who can do it, we want to sort of see if we can get there ourselves. We want to get there. I mean, it definitely attracts just a certain competitive person, though, I think, because, you know, the only kind of people who are going to bash their head against the wall and try to figure something like this out are the kind of people who would, you know, go decide to run a triathlon. Or, you know, this is kind of a funny story. The young man who taught me to do it is so competitive that at his wedding, his wife, who he met solving Rubik's Cube, they eschewed the first dance entirely, and their two passions are jiu-jitsu and Rubik's Cube. So instead of a first dance in front of the whole wedding party, they dragged out a wrestling mat. They put on their gis, and they inaugurated the noble sport of cube jitsu, in which you either get the other person to submit or you solve the cube first, and you win. And so his now wife was choking him out with her leg in a hold, and he managed to solve the cube one-handed before he ran out of oxygen, so he won. So I think that just gives you an idea of how competitive people get with this. Like, it, you know, it requires an enormous degree of skill to do it fast. Anyone can learn to solve the puzzle. Really, anybody can. My mother vowed to do it by the time the book came out, and she did. But it invites competition, and for the same reasons that I think just running or swimming or any sort of basic activity does, because, you know, once you can do it, you know, some people might put it down and never do it again, but it begs this question, can you do it better? And if you can do it better, how good are you compared to somebody else? So it just starts the ball rolling like that.
Well, first of all, I think your friend needs to trademark cube jitsu, because that could be on pay-per-view.
Yeah, I'd watch that. I'd watch that.
My guest today is Ian Scheffler. He is a writer and Rubik's Cube enthusiast devotee. His book is titled Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cubes Solving. Long subtitle there. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa as he talks about his passion for solving the cube, his involvement in competitive cube solving. Now, when you first went to that first event, it was at the old, I believe it was the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas.
That's right.
You participated in your first competition. What were your times like?
So at the time, I averaged, because in competition you do five solves, the best and worst are removed, and the other three are averaged. So you rank by your average. I averaged about a minute and 45 seconds, which for the layperson is great.
Like, that sounds awesome.
In high school I would do that, and people would be really impressed, you know. But then when I was there, like the judge, I remember the judge just kind of looking at the clock, like, you know, a school kid waiting to get out of class, like, is this guy really going to take that long? Like, you know, because the top people there were all under, you know, under 20 seconds, which is the goal I try to go for in the book. But, you know, I was basically where anybody was who had learned to solve it and sort of didn't know there's anything beyond it.
No, at that first competition, you got an interesting advice, piece of advice that shows up in the subtitle there. You need to go slow to go fast.
Right. And so this is one of the things I've learned in cubing that I think applies to everyday life in a very funny way, which is that, you know, when you're in a stressful, tense situation and you're trying to achieve a goal, it's sort of like that, you know, Eastern Taoist idea of, like, you know, the harder you try, the worse you do. You have to really relax to achieve what you want to achieve. And I had been, you know, on my last solve, I really was not solving as well as I wanted to. And I was told, you know, you should try going slower, which to me didn't make sense. Although I'd heard a lot of fast cubers, you know, like this one Australian teenager who was called the Usain Bolt of solving Rubik's Cube. He was the first to break 10 seconds for average. And Felix Zemdegs, he said that the faster he went, the slower it felt, which on the face of it really doesn't make sense. You know, if you're going faster, you're going faster, you know. But I decided to follow their advice, and I decided to not pay attention to the clock on that last solve. And, you know, every moment suddenly became so full of activity and pregnant with meaning that I really expected it to be my slowest solve of the competition. But when I put that the cube down, and I, you know, you got this timing pad on the table, like a touch pad, I sort of touched it softly like I was kind of finishing a piano sonata or something. I wasn't even trying to go fast. And it was like a personal best by like 10 seconds. And I was like, holy cow. And everyone was like, yeah, that's what we've been telling you, man. So it really requires this, you know, the kind of mind, you know, psychologists call it the flow state, which is the meditative space that you get if you're a ballerina turning on stage, or you're a wide receiver jumping in the air to catch a football, or you're a baseball player watching that fastball grow huge over the plate. Like, you're just so in the zone that time itself kind of slows down. You know, and that's really the last place you want to be if you're on stage in front of hundreds of people and need to rely on your fine motor skills. But it really is a good kind of crucible for testing yourself.
Now, from that first competition, you were hooked. You were talking to all sorts of speed cube solvers and talking to some of the fast, at that point, some of the fast in the world, which were around in the 9 to 10 second range.
Yeah, I mean, they averaged under 10 seconds. Like, the very best folks in the world, believe it or not now, are averaging just like maybe 5 people who've averaged under 7 seconds, which is just mind-blowing. You know, it's not just once. It's like over the course of 5 solves. So, yeah, I was trying to pick their brains and understand, you know, and understand their stories. Because, you know, what drives someone to get that devoted to a puzzle, you know? Like that Australian guy I mentioned, he did it so much growing up that he had a parakeet. And you know how those birds will imitate noises? It started making cube noises when he wasn't around, because that's all it would hear, you know, when he was around the house. So, yeah, I started trying to pick their brains and understand how they did what they did.
You also wanted to get to the heart of the cube, and that was to talk to Erno Rubik, who is notoriously reclusive. I think you write that really one of the only big articles with him goes back to the 1980s with John Tierney for Science Magazine. I mean, he's not spoken to a whole lot, and that was also a part of what you were trying to do, going to actually to Hungary, where this cube came from. You said he really didn't anticipate it to be a puzzle. It was more of a design thing, was it?
Yeah. So, I mean, Mr. Rubik is a lot like his own puzzle, in that if you ask different people the same question, you often get as many answers as the number of people you ask, and they don't really square with each other. I like to think of him a bit as the Willy Wonka of Eastern Europe, because he's very wealthy, very reclusive, and very, you know, brilliant. And yeah, it took me 2 years of persistent trying to line up an interview with him, which was one of the most surreal hours of my life, because I found out firsthand that, you know, most people in Hungary know who he is, but they all think he's dead at this point. They don't realize he's still alive. He keeps such a low profile. Like, you know, I was in a museum there, and there was a video about the history of the whole country. And the opening image was a Rubik's Cube. You know, I mean, it used to be on the stamps. It's a very big part of the national consciousness. Hungarians are very proud of it. You know, you can walk into the open-air markets and find little tchotchkes with cubes on them. The same way in New York, you can get keychains with the Empire State Building. And yet, you know, Mr. Rubik is more or less an enigma there, just as he is here. I mean, I didn't even know that he existed, in the sense that the Rubik's Cube is a possessive, right? Just like Einstein's theory of relativity. If you talk to Mr. Rubik, he doesn't say Rubik's Cube. He says my cube, because it's his cube. He made it, you know. That's his right. So, yeah, I got to talk to him, and I really wanted to try to just get a sense of, you know, what was the mind like that created this? Because, as you say, he never set out to create the world's most popular puzzle, and it certainly has taken him aback, both how popular it was at first and how it's made this comeback in the last 15 years. He invented it when he was 29 years old, and he was living at home with his mother behind the Iron Curtain, which is perhaps the least auspicious place in history for a successful commercial product to be invented, but, you know, there you have it. And it took over half a decade to get out to the wider world, and there was this whole crazy story involving a Holocaust survivor who married into the British aristocracy, finding it at a German toy fair and bringing it to the States. And, you know, when he finally got an American company to the table to talk about licensing it, you know, they said, well, you have to show us that you can solve it first. And the Hungarians were like, but logic dictates, you know, if you start out and it's solved and you mix it up, you must be able to solve it again. And the Americans were like, no, none of this logical claptrap. We want a demonstration. And then they showed that it could be solved, and they signed a deal, and it made it out to the West. But Mr. Rubik at first, like I said, when he invented it, he didn't even know if it could be solved. So he was in the same predicament. He was creating sort of an impossible object, you know, because it's a cube, but you can twist it an infinite number of times, and it's not a cube. It can change, but it also doesn't change. It's kind of like this philosophical quandary made real. And he was a teacher of design and architecture. He is a practicing architect. And he only put stickers on it so he could keep track of the pieces. His first one was just made of, like, wooden blocks and paper clips and rubber bands. And he started twisting it, and he, in an unpublished manuscript, said it was sort of like going for a walk. Like, you see a lot of pretty things and things you haven't seen before. He'd never seen these kind of patterns. But But then at a certain point, you want to go home, right? And so he tried to go home, like, and that was the big moment when he realized he didn't know how. And he spent months trying to solve it. And there's this kind of fun story that's apocryphal. I don't know if it's true, but I hope it is, that, you know, his mother, who he was living with, said, you know, he came out of his room and he said, "I can't do it. It's impossible." And she said what he later said to the Americans, like, you know, if you started out solved, you have to solve it. And defeated by logic, he wandered back to his bedroom and managed to figure it out eventually.
Now, you mentioned you spent 2 years trying to talk to Rubik, and it actually came about as a lunch meeting with another close associate that included Rubik. And you did something really interesting in talking with him, because what became apparent as you were searching him out was one of the reasons he didn't talk was because people always ask him the same sort of questions. So you brought him a different puzzle, and that immediately engaged his mind.
That's right. I figured, really, you know, pretty much every time in his whole life he's ever been asked about anything, it's about his cube, and that was a long time ago. So I've met some pretty interesting puzzle designers. There's a man in San Francisco named George Miller who's so enthusiastic about puzzles that he threw out his washer and dryer to replace them with a 3D printer, and I don't know how he does the laundry, but I'm not sure he cares. So he gave me a puzzle that's at once very simple and very complicated. It's like a prism with a marble stuck in it, and you have to try to take it apart and put it back together. And I knew Mr. Rubik had never seen it because it was brand new. And so I brought it to him and I gave it to him, and he immediately lost all interest in me in the conversation and just started trying to figure it out. And he didn't have enough time to solve it, but he got way further than I did. And he clearly understood the mechanism. And it was just, you know, he is a lot like his own puzzle. Like, one thing he said to me that really touched me and I thought was very thought provoking was that, you know, his cube is a finished object, meaning, you know, it's self-contained. You don't need to know any particular language or set of skills. There's no instructions you need. Anyone anywhere in the world can pick it up. I've found old photos in National Geographic of kids wearing loincloths in the jungle in Brazil playing with it. And they, you know, had no contact with the Western world. But he said it's also incomplete, meaning you can sort of do things with it, make art, inspire your fashion design, you know, deal with math problems. And so he's a lot like that. You know, he's got so many sides to him, so to speak. He can talk about math. He can talk about art. He can talk about sports. We spent a lot of time talking about, is solving Rubik's Cube a sport or not? That's a
right.
question that he had a lot of stuff to say about. And so, you know, it was amazing how he could just switch gears from talking to me about art and the cube to paying no attention to me, just playing with that puzzle, to coming back in with this, like, practically lecture coming right out of his brain about sports and what are sports. And, you know, he's easily the most fascinating person I've ever met.
One of the questions I had about, you know, because you go through the algorithms needed to really solve the cube fast, I'm wondering, are there real-world math applications from some of the techniques these incredibly fast solvers do to get to 5 seconds or 6 seconds, you know, 50 moves in 6 seconds? Seems like there would be some real-life application. Did you find any?
Yeah, well, it sort of runs the other way, where there's like real-world math that has real applications that can be applied to the cube. As far as I know, because there have been some pretty novel, there was one problem of trying to figure out the so-called God's number of Rubik's Cube, which is like, you know, if an omniscient being were solving the puzzle, they would always do it the best way. And so what would be the maximum number of moves you need? And that took 30 years to figure out, and supercomputers at Google and all these professors. But as far as I know, that hasn't directly applied to something, but the math they use to figure it out is like called group theory, and that has applications from computer security to, you know, every day we're dealing with it when we, you know, order something online and the package gets tracked using group theory operations to cut through a lot of data. So as far as there have been some developments in robotics, which are kind of interesting in terms of dexterity, because there's been a race for a long time where people were trying to design robots that could solve cubes faster than humans, which was a real challenge because they could develop efficient solutions on a computer, but robots are not very good with their hands if they have them. So,
right.
You know, it took a lot of effort, and ultimately some guys figured out how to use Legos to make a robotic kit that could solve the cube faster than us. But I maintain that it's a little unfair because he gave it four hands. So.
Now, as you embarked on your own personal quest to get under 20 seconds, you developed something that Dr. Douglas Waugh encountered that he wrote to the New England Journal of Medicine. Something that I guess has been called Cuber's thumb.
That's right. I'm always a little embarrassed when this comes up because the idea of getting a sports injury from solving Rubik's cubes is so absurd. But, you know, I feel a little better when I think about that he wrote about it right next to somebody else writing it about tobacco rollers' wrists. So, you know, there's always some weird stress injury out there, right? But, you know, yeah, I was solving in such a way that I was using one of my thumbs more than I needed to. And it it was really agonizing because I at home got down to almost under 20 seconds. And the reason 20 seconds was important is that's like the 4-minute mile of solving a Rubik's Cube. And I had been challenged to break it by the kid who taught me years ago. And I wanted to get there sort of A, to know what it was like and to understand this from the inside out. And B, because I'm a competitive guy too. And I wanted to have that mark of distinction. And I literally got to 20.1 seconds at home. I was 0.1 of a second away. And I injured my thumb and I couldn't pick up a cube for like 3 months. And I was just watched my sort of speed drain away and I had to relearn to solve it. And the story kind of turns into like the Karate Kid where like, but inverted, where like a lot of kids smaller than me are teaching me what to do. And, you know, some of these algorithms have really funny names, like, you know, the sexy move and stuff like this. I tried to find out why they call it that. And the guy was like, it's just sexy. And I'm like, if you say so, you know.
Now, eventually you do get under 20 seconds, but really that 20 seconds, I think you've detailed in the book how speeds have gotten so much faster. Where does 20 seconds rank you in the world as far as the fastest cube solvers?
So at the moment, when I last checked, which is pretty recently, it's about 80th percentile worldwide because the number of people who do this just keeps growing and you actually have to get faster just to maintain your ranking. But it's about the 80th percentile, which is certainly respectable. Like, you know, it's a legit sort of, it's like, oh, you're a legit speed cuber if you're under 20 seconds. But, you know, at this point, the top 100 in the world, you know, even almost top 1,000 is practically under 10 seconds. And it, you know, only 6 years ago, no one had averaged under 10 seconds and now almost 1,000 people have. So it's all getting so fast. I mean, just the other weekend, there were 7 world records broken on the same day at different competitions all around the world. There was a 4.74 of a single solve. There was a guy in China who's the best blindfold solver, and he solved it in just 18 and a half seconds, which isn't like he blindfolded himself and then did it. That includes the time in which he memorized the puzzle. So he looked at it for like 10 seconds, put a blindfold on, and solved it in 8.5 seconds.
Wow. And that is actually a thing where they do this blindfolded solving where you study the puzzle, you put on the blindfold, and then start solving it.
Yeah. I mean, my personal favorite to watch, which I think is really the craziest, is called multiple blindfold, where you have an hour and you can try as many cubes as you want. But the rule is that once you start solving them, you have to put the blindfold on and you can never take it off. So you basically got to solve them all in a row, blindfolded. And the world record is, I think, 41 cubes in an hour. Done by this one guy in Poland. And, you know, if you watch the YouTube video, it's sped up because it takes a long time to watch, but he just kind of manically studies each. He's wearing a tuxedo and like a sleep mask. It's a very strange combination. He's got manically looking at all the puzzles. He puts it on, and I think he plays the Flight of the Bumblebee in the video, and he just sort of like solves all the cubes in a row, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the way up to 41. And, you know, that always blows my mind. Like, I'll go watch that just for fun, even though I'm still learning to do it blindfolded because obviously that's not a piece of cake. They do it with their feet. The world record for doing it with your feet is 20 seconds now. This one guy in Poland, again, Poland has the most cubers per capita in the world. They call it pro land in the community. And there's one guy there, almost like he's built like a fullback, like a really solid guy named Jakub Kipa. And he just has feet like a chimpanzee. Like he'll just start manipulating that cube like crazy. And I got to see him do it live at the World Championship. And it's really blown away. It's really amazing what people can do given enough time. No.
A lot of time and a lot of thought.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really interesting book into this whole world of cube solvers, Cracking the Cube. Ian, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Writer Ian Scheffler is the author of Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. It's published by Touchstone Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.